The following is a presentation by Miriam T. McGillis, a Dominican sister who has lectured widely for the past 10 years on the need for the stewardship of the earth and planetary citizenship. She is the founder and director of Genesis Farm in Blairstown, New Jersey, and a trustee of Global Education Associates of New York.
Good evening, everyone. It's really my delight to be with you this evening and to have some time to reflect on this whole extraordinary question on the fate of the Earth, which is something we certainly have never had to deal with as a human species before. And I've had the experience of the past week has brought me from San Diego up to some other stops along the way, and mostly meeting with people who just share these deep concerns, and it has been an extraordinary time for me to just be able to be in the energy of so much concern and commitment. So I want to say from the beginning that I am really very grateful for your efforts, your commitment, and your presence here tonight. I think it is a tremendous gift we are about giving to our children and our grandchildren. It's certainly not an easy thing to deal with some of the questions that we're so inundated with by the whole circle of events that constantly bring deeper and deeper levels of anxiety to us. We know that we're certainly living in times, well, as the bishops call them, of supreme crises. It's a very disconcerting term. And yet, that's the reality of our lives. And it is no accident that we're born now, that we find our lives unfolding now with our particular histories and our gifts and our brokenness and our experiences and our wisdoms. It's not an accident. And in talking about the fate of the earth, we know that that's really up for grabs. We're at a moment where there are no guarantees as to its future. It's a question of our own critical choices. And I think that really what we are deeply in need of is a transforming vision, a vision that's deep enough that can take us from where we are and bring us into a new place that opens the future up to hope. And I think that's really what we've got to be about, is being people of hope. And that's what I hope this evening's reflection will be about, because I'm going to just be sharing a context with you that was given to me and that has made all the difference in my own life in terms of helping me to understand that just as one single tiny fragile person, I know my life is significant because of the context. And that was a gift. And so I would like to have the time to share that with you. So I'm going to be speaking very much tonight from the writings of someone else, a man by the name of Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry is a passionist priest, and he happens to be the president of the American Teilhard Association. And if you know anything about Teilhard de Chardin, he just happened to be a Jesuit priest who died in, I think, 1952. But probably within institutionalized Western religion, he's probably the first person to bring together in his own psyche the insights that come out of thousands of years of a spiritual tradition, a faith tradition, with the contemporary scientific tradition. And he put both of those together, and he integrated them into a worldview that has probably done more to shape the modern world than any of us really yet understand. But he died before the ecological crisis. He died before the popular perception of the Earth as a living system in the way we've come to know it now. And Thomas Berry has really tried to take his work and bring it up into the 80s. And that's what we'll be looking at tonight. So often we look at questions of the fate of the earth and the critical state in which it now unfolds, and we say that we're undergoing a kind of moral failure. It's so easy to read the signs of the times and blame ourselves for a lack of spirituality, a lack of religious fervor, that to accept the fact that we're just an inherently greedy, selfish, destructive species, and that that's just the state of affairs. And that if we only could come up with a religious revival, it would be all right. We're suffering from a moral and ethical decline. And I'm not saying that there aren't levels of truth in that. But I think that there's really another area that we've got to look at before we make that the last conclusion. And that's what I would like to suggest we do tonight. Father Berry would say what we're really in a crisis of is cosmology. Now, what does cosmology mean? It simply means that we all have stories wherein we understand how the universe was made. And all peoples of the planet have that story. It's their origin story. It's our Genesis story. Or it's whatever people put together as their observation of the origin of the world, and then what the world is made of. And that we, at this particular point of time, find ourselves in a crisis that has to do with that. Not necessarily a crisis of evil. And I think when we look at it that way, we can begin to see that the future does open up to hope. And it gives us the capacity to rethink the whole thing with an expanded view of it. And it gives us images that are positive, and so we're able to live out of those images. Because if our images of the future are negative, and that's what we live out of, in other words, we're an inherently destructive species, or these are the end times, if we live out of those images, we're going to bring them about. Because our images of the future are really self-fulfilling. And it's awfully important to constantly read the signs of the times in broader ways, and to deal with the signs of the times and allow the pain of them to come into us and not be paralyzed by them, and above all, not to deny them. There's an extraordinary short poem by Wendell Berry that has really touched this for me personally, especially in this past year. I've just been living with it in my heart over and over and over again. Because it speaks to a realistic understanding of what's happening and an ability to live with and cope with all of that pain, and yet see that one's own life can be significant if one has a deeper understanding of what's happening. And it goes something like this. In the dark of the moon, in the dead of night, in the dead of winter, in flying snow, the world in danger, families dying, war spreading, I walk the rocky hillside sowing clover. And that kind of hope in the significance of doing things for life is what we've got to be about. It reminds me of a story of an old woman in the Mideast who planted a date. And you know, the thing about planting dates is that when you plant them, you know you're never going to eat them, because it takes about 80 years for a date to grow into a tree with roots deep enough to take that scarce water and bring it up to the surface and produce the fruit. And the thing about that is that you don't need to have that, well, that if you understand the process, you can make the commitment. And the thing about date trees is that in that 80-year period of time, they get so buffeted by sandstorms and windstorms and all kinds of impacts on the growth of the tree, that for the most part the tree looks like it's dying during those 80 years. And if you didn't understand that, if you didn't understand that that's just the process, you could easily come in and make a judgment about the severity of its condition and cut it down. You have to live out of the image of what is going to happen. And that's what I'm talking about, living out of our images of hope. And I think a perspective that can come out of cosmology can enable us to do that. And that's what we've got to do, because hope is a choice. We make a choice to hope. And once you do that, then it makes all the difference in the world about what you do. So let's look at that idea of cosmology and see what it is that connects here. A people's cosmology or origin story predates everything else that they create by way of culture, religion, economics, politics, whatever. If we were to look at just a comparison to bring this out, it'll make a little more sense. But for instance, the native peoples who lived in this area before our European ancestors came over, they were operating out of a cosmology, a scientific, primitive, but it was their experience of the world that helped them shape an explaining story. And that story gave them a sense that the Great Spirit, the divine creator force, lived inside the universe, lived in the earth. And because they believed that, and because they believed then that the earth was made up of the presence of the spirit, that's what determined how they evolved their religious systems and their manners of worshiping and coming in contact with the divine. That's what determined how they shaped their morals, their ethical systems, and how they shaped their economic systems. Because if the spirit was inside things, then everything that lived was a relative of the spirit and reflected in a concrete incarnate way the power of the spirit being transmitted through that creature. So for instance, to take the feather of the eagle and to wear that was a way of being in touch with the power that the eagle reflected about the divine. It when you understand that the water or the trees are relatives and that the only reason they're breathing is because the breath of the spirit is in them, then it changes your entire relationship to what lives. That's why it was impossible for them ever to come up with an economic concept like private property. They lived here for 7 to 10,000 years, and it never dawned on them that they could own or buy or sell land. And that was the problem when they met the Europeans. They were using language and concepts, but their understandings of them were totally different. I mean, they thought the settlers who bought Manhattan Island were crazy. How could you own or buy or sell this womb, this earth mother that gave you birth and would take you back? It was incongruous. And it wasn't because of their religion, it was because of their cosmology. Now, if we were to look for a moment at the cosmology which has shaped the whole evolution of the West, this will start to make some sense when we look at what's happening presently on the planet. Because fundamentally, we're at a point of time where we're all shifting our perspectives about our cosmology, and we have these new insights, and we have the implications of this new cosmology that we have, but we're living within institutions that are totally rooted in the old one, and they're inflexible. You can't make a shift within structures like you can make a shift in understanding, and the ambiguity and the tension and the conflict we're experiencing is part of the process of the pain and what makes it so difficult to find out how to deal with it. But basically, in the cosmology, which is the premise out of which Western civilization grows, even though there are different stories among the peoples who eventually comprise the root of Western civilization, there are a couple of implications in those stories that have the same sense. And the first is that however the divine, or the deities, or the gods, or whatever, however they were imaged, they were seen as being fundamentally transcendent to the universe. They lived outside of the universe. They were greater than it. This god or gods created this. This was different from God, and God was a transcendent being who had power and dominion over it and was far greater, different than it, apart from it, other than the world. And we had a sense of the human as being very intrinsically connected to the divine, as having that as its significance and its, a union with the divine. But in order for the human to do that, the human too had to transcend the world of material reality to go to the ideal world. So the locus, the meeting place, was transcendent. And it left simply a scientific, I'm using that word, but this is much more primitive, it left a perception of the world in purely material terms. Because the world was not involved in that process. It didn't have an inherent spiritual dimension. It was understood in totally material terms. Now, it was a reflection of the divine, and it was therefore holy, but it was not spirit, it was material. And that perception enabled Western peoples to sort of have a sense of detachment from it and a sense of dominion over it. In some instances, that was terribly abused. In other instances, it evolved into a sense of stewardship. But it was to care for what was a reflection of the divine. It was still material. Now, that sense of detachment is what enabled us to probe it. We were observers. So therefore, we could probe it and figure out how it worked and look into its physical, purely material, mechanistic parts and figure out how they worked. And then in that understanding, use that knowledge and apply it to what we call technology, whether it's as simple as creating a wheel or whether it's the kind of technology we're shaping today. We only can do what we're doing because of that cosmology. Now, ironically, it was because of that that the whole evolution of Western history is marked by this ever-broadening and deepening knowledge of the physical energies of the universe and their application in technology, which has literally made a quantum leap in the last 300 years and just has accelerated unbelievably in the last 50. But it was that cosmology which enabled us in that worldview to take what we thought was the last dense piece of the matter, the atom, in our century, and to take that and learn how to split it open. And of course, in that event, come to the realization that our cosmology was completely inadequate, that we were living on out of a set of assumptions that no longer could become the underpinnings of what we do, because they're no longer truthful. Because as we have probed the interior of the atom, we've come to see that this whole world that we called material has a non-material dimension, that it's not measurable. It has a deep spiritual, psychic, inner dimension. And as we've probed the universe, and as we've learned its age and learned how to deal with its unfolding, we've come to a totally different perception about the universe and a totally different perception about the Earth. So we've had to move from this ready-made spatial universe, totally furnished, completely made, all set up, which we simply inherited, and walk on top of, to an understanding of a universe that is in process, and that from the beginning, from the very, very beginning, has had a deep spiritual interior, and which has been expanding and unfolding over eons of time, and that our planet and our solar system is just a recent manifestation, a recent development of a sequence of events that began 15 billion years ago. and that we're a direct connection with that. And that's what I just want to talk about for a little bit, and look at how that changes the way we begin to define ourselves, our crises, and our way of opening up into the future. Now, if I can get through all these wires and get over here and get mobile, we'll be all right. Okay. We're up. Does this stretch far enough? It doesn't. Okay, then we move the blackboard. Good. At this point of our history, we're beginning to grapple with a universe that began about 15 billion years ago with the emergence of hydrogen from that first creative act which brought it into being. Now, I happen to be a person of faith, and so my explanation of that origin is that that comes from a divine source who has within it all the potential that the universe can possibly reflect. But whatever our understanding of that beginning, we are the first generation on the planet at least to have the story in a new context. So if we were to look at that from the beginning until now, this 15 billion year process, we'd see that the universe began with hydrogen, and it was hydrogen for only about 7 seconds, according to those who know better than I do. But out of the union of hydrogen atoms came the unfolding of helium. And out of the unfolding of helium came carbon. And once you have those differentiated elements in place, then the universe begins to unfold to greater and greater and greater levels of complexity, with the capacity of those elements to unite and make new combinations as they get more and more complex. But that from the very beginning, as we're discovering, within the hydrogen are spaces so vast that they're immeasurable, that there is an interior dimension. So that not only in terms of its external expression in more and more complex arrangements of these elements, not only does the universe begin to unfold externally, but in terms of its interior dimension, it begins to become more capable of unfolding greater and greater complexity in order to realize its potential. And when our sun came into being some 5 billion years ago in this process, and with our sun, our solar system, by that time there were atomic elements capable of becoming the heavy metals which eventually form the crust of the Earth. It's the elemental structures within the atoms of the sun which are unique. And our planet then goes back about 5 billion years. So we're very young in the universe, but this is a single continuum. This is one event. It's one event present to itself in the unfolding of the process. So if we were to look at our Earth in the past 5 billion years and look at its development, we begin to see an extraordinary acceleration of that complex structure. But it's the universe we're talking about. It's the Earth we're talking about. Now, I can't imagine 5 billion. That number totally escapes me. You might as well say 5 million is 5 billion. And some popular scientific writers help us to get a handle on that by saying, well, supposing you take that 5 billion and compress that into the framework of 12 months. And watch the process unfold in a stepped up speed. So let's do that. If 5 billion could equal 1 year, then we could begin to see how the Earth takes on a totally new unfolding of the potential for life. From its first gaseous state, from the molten gases it was made out of, which are still burning in the core of the Earth right now, and so responsible for so many of the earthquakes and tidal waves that we're still feeling. The time that it took for that burning to produce gases which could evaporate and come down and become the oceans out of which all life forms have an indebtedness, we'd see that it would have taken the Earth about 8 months of the year to create the conditions through an unbroken sequence of events which enabled the crust to cool, the oceans to form, continents to shape themselves, for the development of complex structures that created amino acids which came together to form protein. We would see that it took the first 8 months of the year for the conditions necessary for life to unfold in that process. So life as we know it on the planet unfolded about 4 months ago. And then out of that process, in terms of greater and greater and greater genetic complexity, the Earth began to, in the most extraordinary way, express itself through life with breathing. It learned to breathe. It learned to see as it developed vision, the organs of vision within the living creatures that began to unfold. It learned to hear with the development of audio faculties within its creatures. It learned how to reproduce itself. It learned how to nourish itself. It learned how to heal itself. But it's the Earth that we're talking about. It's the Earth in this inner psychic dimension becoming more and more capable of expressing the spiritual dimension as the external material dimension unfolded. But the subject we're talking about is the Earth. And if we were to trace the last 4 months of life on the planet, then it would have taken the last 4 months of increasing complexity and diversification for the Earth now to unfold within itself a brain so highly evolved, a nervous system so highly organized, a skeletal structure so highly organized, that the Earth now was capable not just of living and breathing and moving and feeding itself and reproducing and healing itself and seeing and hearing, but now it had evolved an organism so complex that the Earth was capable of thinking about itself. And that's the human. The human is the being in whom the Earth has become spiritually aware, has awakened into consciousness, has become self-aware and self-reflecting. In the human, the Earth begins to reflect on itself, its meaning, who it is. And in our deepest definition and deepest subjectivity, humans are the Earth, conscious. So you and I are the beings in whom the Earth thinks, knows, comprehends, analyzes, rationalizes, judges, remembers, chooses, acts, decides. And of course, we're not used to thinking of ourselves that way at all. As a matter of fact, it's rather upsetting to look at that. Because we don't know what to do with it. It doesn't fit into any of our categories. But as Teilhard would say, the human person is the sum total of 15 billion years of unbroken evolution now thinking about itself. That's who you are. And you are irreplaceable and unrepeatable. And the way the Earth is thinking at this moment in you is totally unique. Totally. And we'll never think that way again. What's difficult for us to shift gears with this whole thing is that we've learned to understand ourselves within the social paradigm that has been given to us in our whole educational process, which has remained unchanged for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We've developed cultures, we've developed religion, we've developed economics, we've developed science and technology, but the basic underlying given, the assumption that was never questioned underneath all of that, was the assumption about the materiality of the universe. And now all of a sudden, we're living, moving, acting, breathing, working, learning, doing everything we do within institutions that give meaning and substance to our lives, and the basic assumption out of which all of them are made is the assumption that the world is material and we're separate, special creatures that have nothing to do with that and are disconnected from that. But we already are about 20, 25 years into starting to grasp some of the implications that are coming to us, maybe not from an organized way, but from all these messages we're getting about the world, about the natural systems, especially since the period of the 60s with the ecological awareness, that we've, the environmental awareness that began then. And we're in terrible conflict because we know this thing is not working. But we don't have a roadmap. We don't have an ethics that's defined and ready to pass on or to give us a new direction in our lives. And that's part of the anguish of our times, and it's part of why we've got to deal with it. We've got to struggle with this, look at it, chew it up, integrate it. If it doesn't fit, all right. But if there's truth in it, we've really got to deal with it because it changes everything. Let's look at what that really means in terms of the consequences of this. If we could take, well, in this time frame, you see, the human, too, has only been around one day. We're the youngest species, and we're very new, and very young, and very primitive. It might be a miscalculation to say we're human. We might be still pre-human. Except for some great enlightened beings who walked the planet as totally human. But we've only been around one day, and we're very young. Now, if you could take this last day that we have been around and stretch that out a little bit to get a sense of our human history, well, in the past 24 hours that we've been on the planet, or that the planet's been conscious of itself and thinking about itself, and it could only do it with what it was aware of, and it was as aware as the primitive people looking around their world. Right up until now. It's as aware as you and I are aware. No more, no less. So if we were to look at the 24 hours that we've been around, we know that the majority of that time was spent in the great tribal age, that dark period of which we know almost nothing, that predates what we call in our history books ancient history. We could only write ancient history out of the old cosmology. Anyway, the time we spent that is prior to what we call ancient history was the first 23 and a half hours of the day. This is the tribal age, and we know almost nothing about it. This is where consciousness began to awaken and unfold, and our human ancestors went through the extraordinary process of learning to abstract thought and shape symbols and create something as highly complex as language, and learn in extraordinary circumstances to survive in social ways and develop meaning systems. Well, the great civilizations, which we write about in our ancient history, they began about 30 minutes ago. And it was in this time frame that we wrote our cosmology, which was basically our science. So you see that this, too, is relatively very new, and we've been operating out of it, and it has given great coherence to our sense of purpose and meaning. It was a paradigm which gave us a story of how we fit in the whole thing and the meaning which has brought us up into the present. It's not evil, it's just what is. It was what we knew. But what's happened in the past half hour, and especially In the past few moments, which is just a blip in this whole thing, which we might call this scientific industrial age, is that in this time frame, our knowledge has exploded and our power has exploded so astronomically that through us, through what we now know, the Earth is coming to a new moment of awareness. It's learning the story. It's learning where it came from and who it is. It's coming into a new phase. And we who are the 5.5 billion people who are around the rim of that little planet, we who are its thought, it's in us right now that the Earth is coming to this awareness. And our understanding has become so deepened and broadened that we are literally bringing the Earth into a whole new phase in its unfolding, as radical as the shift from non-life to life or life to conscious life. The shift that's happening now is that consciousness has such a knowledge and understanding and power over the process that knowledge or consciousness is starting to take control of it. It's going off remote control. This whole process has come about through an internal guidance system, for want of a better term. Now we know the way it's been operating, and we have the power to turn it off automatic and put it on manual. That's what's happening. Consciousness is taking over. Now that's extraordinary. I mean, that is just, we could all walk out right now and just deal with that. But I want to make that specific so that we can see what it is and the depth of what it is that we're really talking about. Look at the area of genetics, for instance. All genetics is, in terms of the breakthrough, the scientific breakthrough, where we've broken the code of DNA, we've gone inside the chromosome, we know how it works, we can figure out the genetic memory that has been accumulating and imprinting itself within the gene over this whole process, this whole time. We know now how that works. Consciousness understands it. And our knowledge of it and our power over it is now giving us the capacity to go in and rearrange it and shape, to interfere with the process and alter it to whatever we decide we want it to be. That's what's really happening. So in a very real sense, the whole breakthrough in biogenetic engineering is the story of the Earth coming off remote control and beginning to consciously shape the future evolution of life. That's what's really happening. And of course, the question for this little planet over there, who's only us, is do we, who are this consciousness, have we arrived at anywhere near the level of integrity or wisdom or maturity to do what we can do with the truthfulness that it had when it was on remote control? We're like adolescents with these extraordinary powers, but without the life experience to integrate the power into a larger context. And that question is so profound, because at this moment we're getting ready to begin that exploration and put out into the entirety organisms which did not pre-exist and which did not come out of this slow, laborious process wherein at each stage the conditions that were there all worked together in this finely tuned balancing act to enable the conditions for the survival and ongoing process to continue toward life. And if we err, if the finely tuned balancing act which sustains this planet right now into the most extraordinary life community in our solar system, if this gets violated, if it goes off, if it becomes totally whacked out, the only cause of that will have been its own consciousness, because without consciousness, on internal control, it was moving toward life and toward sustainable life. And it isn't that, it's not even so much a question, I don't think, of ethics, because you have very fine, righteous people who love their husbands and wives and their kids and don't tell lies and they're pure and they're all sorts of good people. And it doesn't make any difference, their goodness doesn't make any difference if they're operating out of the old cosmology when they get into this. It's not a question of ethics. It can become a question of ethics. But you see, we don't have a tradition of ethics out of which to do this. Because our cosmology created an ethical system that was human, human, human God, but not human universe process. We don't have it. The Indians do, but we don't. Another example of that is that we now know that we're alive, the Earth is alive, because unlike Mars or the Moon or Venus or the other planets in our solar system, we're a water planet. 70% of the Earth's surface is salt water, and that is totally significant. That's why the Earth's alive. It's a fluid planet. But in our old cosmology, we call those fluids oceans. We name them Atlantic, Pacific, Arctic, Antarctic. They're places, they're things, they're its, they're stuffs. And you swim in them, you fish in them, you sail in them, you own them. You own home fronts on them. And so they've become extraordinarily convenient places because they're so far away to put all the kinds of things that we've suddenly learned how to create that we don't know what to do with, that we know are becoming lethal. And if your cosmology is such that those are just places, that's very logical to do that. But of course, now we're understanding that the Earths are the water is the fluids, the oceans are the fluids of the planet. And everything that lives has the ocean in it. The ocean isn't, they're not oceans, there's one single salt water system, and it flows through everything on the surface of the Earth that has life in it. That's why things are alive. Either maple trees or banana trees or you. If we took you to the chemistry lab and had you analyzed right now, I don't care how much you weigh, you're 70% salt water. And it's the same salt water as what we call the oceans. The rest of you are the minerals that form the crust of the earth. We're the earth with consciousness, with soul, with spirit. We're the earth in a new place, but we're the earth. And now we're understanding that these fluids which are within the earth, within the oceans are in us. Because the oceans become the clouds, and the clouds become the rain, and the rain becomes the corn, and we eat the corn. And we get our minerals and our salt water replaced. And we cry the ocean. We excrete the ocean. And we're beginning to understand that the oceans are alive because they're a fabric of life. And in this long, painstaking process toward life, they became a fabric of millions of varied species, organisms, all of which are a fabric and community of life. Totally interdependent, all essential for their own for each other's existence, for the well-being of the whole to function and constantly maintain the oxygen that everything that lives needs. And as we continue to put our toxins in there, we're beginning to see that there are gaps in the fabric. That these biological organisms, which never evolved with the capacity to endure this sudden onslaught of new substances, is having its impact. They can't reproduce. They're becoming extinct. And as one becomes extinct, the food chain gets altered. And as those toxins build up in the food chain, higher and higher species are becoming extinct so that the oceans can literally die. Jacques Cousteau says we have very few years left. And if we don't change what we're doing, the oceans are going to become toxic. They will have lost their capacity to break down toxins and to keep oxygen flowing. If the oceans do become toxic, then the clouds are going to be toxic, and the rain will be toxic, and the corn will be toxic. And our children will be toxic, and their tears will be toxic. And that's literally the death of the planet. So that if the planet breaks down and dies, the only cause of it will have been consciousness, because without consciousness, the whole thing was coded toward life. Something's interfering with the process. There are dynamics happening that at the lowest, at the most profound level, are altering the capacity of the Earth to do what the universe has mandated it to do, and that is to continue to live and to continue to heal and nourish and regenerate itself. Consciousness is causing the violation of that. And that's us. And I would maintain, not because we're evil, but because we think we have a full deck of cards, and we really don't. And we're dealing like mad. And we're laughing all through the game. And we keep waiting for that other card to come based on our projections of the past. The card's going to show up that'll get us out of the mess. And we don't have the full deck. For that other card to come based on our projection.